Presented by RomulusIT.com, offering remote support for common computer problems. Landry.audio, follow, like, and subscribe. Today we're speaking with former Congressman Dr. Ron Paul, who's been good enough to give us some of his time and talk about the ongoing effects of COVID and his opinions as we lead into the next U.S. presidential election. Dr. Paul, thank you very much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you, Jesse.
So first of all, as I said, we're down under. So can we talk about President Trump for a moment? Can you give us his opinions on what you think he's done well in his first term?
I can give you my opinion cautiously about what I think. You mean just generally how he's done in these last 4 years, 3 years or so?
Yeah, what he's done well, when he's done bad, almost a report card, if you will.
Well, he's all over the place. I think the biggest frustration for many of us who believe in the purity of liberty and a limited government find it very frustrating, because he have a core set of principles that you can look at and know what he's going to do. And sometimes his appointments then reflect this, because he'll appoint somebody that on the Liberty Report will say, hey, this is good, we like this person, but then later on he has to fire him. So it's been inconsistent. I would say the thing that I've liked the most is when about 40 or 50% of the time he's talking about bringing our troops home and not confronting people and not dropping bombs. He's not a non-interventionist like we'd like him to be, but when we look and compare it to even somebody who gets the Peace Prize like an Obama, I mean, Trump is pretty darn good, because the other side, the enemies of Trump are always talking about, the uncontrollable Trump. But the aren't very good on foreign policy. So I would say that I like what he has done on that. I like what he has done on taxes. He's lowered taxes and he's lowered regulations, which has given him, some mileage, because that has helped the economy. We'd have been in a lot worse shape if that hadn't happened. But we still have, a lot of economic problems. But when it comes to whether or not he's a fiscal conservative, I mean, there's no choice. I mean, he doesn't even entertain the thought that you should cut spending, and it's big, and it's not in the hundreds of billions anymore. It's into the trillions of dollars, and so he spends more money than the Democrats. But that's the way it is. The Republicans have never been as good as they claim they are when it comes to spending. And the Democrats are never as good on protecting civil liberties and maybe having a more peaceful foreign policy. They're not very good at that. So at a national, if it weren't for the personalities involved, I would say Trump blends right into the system, that he's for big government with some restraints, but he still believes in printing money, running up the deficit. He's still for the Federal Reserve System that's there to accommodate big business and big banks. So a few good things, but overall, not a whole lot of basic changes have occurred. We're still endorsing same type of policies. But one other thing that I personally liked when he was running and when he won was his willingness to take on the obsession with political correctness. And he just blows them off with, not playing and not worrying about political correctness. But that's also his, makes it him the biggest target, because people get offended. And if you offend somebody, you're supposed to get down on your knee and apologize to them. And I think there's other Americans, and I think that was one of the reasons he won. He was willing to stand up and confront the people who pressure people into doing things for no good reasons. But overall, I've seen a lot worse presidents. Yet, if we come from a libertarian viewpoint, there's a lot more we'd like to see.
When he was brought into the fold and announced as a Republican candidate, how did you feel about that initially, and I guess where you stand on now, and how he's divided the Republican Party between these never Trumpers and the way a lot of them have really jumped on board with this sort of new form of conservatism?
Well, when I heard he was running, I was not impressed at all. I never supported him, and you're an authoritarian. He likes to be an authoritarian. but he said enough things, just sort of like the political correctness and other things, and he was able to capture the evangelical vote, which was pretty unpredictable. He didn't satisfy me for wanting to change, but of course I'm difficult to satisfy, you know, for us. So he campaigned, but never offered me something to say, boy, what I need to get on his team. Right now, I'm still not, you know, I like him and I don't go after him, but I still don't, I don't get enthusiastic about him, mainly because of the off again and the spending and the deficits don't matter. And even though he's better than the others have been on foreign policy, he still does some crazy things on foreign policy. I don't like the idea that he has to look around for a fight, you know, the way he comes out about what we're supposed to do with China and what we're supposed to do with Iran. That doesn't mean that I think we should, you know, ignore them, but I don't think when we go over and Trump has gone over and, you know, and all the presidents do it, we have to show a sign of force and power to show for our national security. We're over there in the South China Sea, messing around and bumping into ships and, you know, flying close to their places. And same thing with Iran. It's so unnecessary. It comes from insecurity. If you have a strong national defense and you're going to stand up for the defense of the country, you don't need an enemy. But that is necessary. Republicans, Democrats need that in order to get the military budget passed. And that's one of our major problems, of the amount of money we spend in the military. We spend more than, what, the next 10 countries altogether? And they're always talking about, we need to build up our military. The one election, early election that I watched carefully was Kennedy, running in 1960. The missile shortage and, you know, the missile crisis. And he was a liberal Democrat, wasn't supposed to be for that. So there's always a military crisis. And even in the midst, I noticed in the midst of the impeachment hearings, last year, they took time off. The leadership on both parties got into the Congress to vote for the budget. And the military budget, you know, so that part isn't easy to satisfy anybody who's really for limited government, because government keeps growing, and it's going to keep growing until the whole thing falls apart, which is coming.
You're already there. I wanted to get to that a little bit later, but when we talk about countries like China and their sphere of influence and the way that they are lending and absorbing debt by taking over assets and infrastructure to develop their sphere of influence, how do you think you should deal with that then? Do we just ignore this?
What China's doing? If they're doing things peacefully, if they're not, killing people, I think, you know, it's can't say it very loud, but I say it all the time because it offends a lot of Americans, because in some ways they're more capitalistic than we are. You know, we go and we work on our empire. We send our troops around, declare that this is our, we will take care of this country and we'll do this. We'll secure our oil and whatnot. But China, what do they do? Oh, they're out making stuff. And the Americans say, hey, they're gouging us and they have all our money and this debt. But that's unbelievably beneficial to us. We have the reserve currency of the world, and that gives us a tremendous advantage. We pay all our bills with fiat money. We subsidize our military and we subsidize our maintaining our empire. And at the same time, China, what do? They keep working and working. They sell us stuff. And we sell it and we buy it, then they end up with a lot of our money. And what do? We send troops to Africa, and we have a lot of active Africa, but it's all militarized. But China goes over there and they invest. So it's tragic, but in many ways, they're not free market capitalists, but they understand the use of capital. and the government manages it, but the government manages our capital too because of the crony capitalism and with all the bailouts that go on and the subsidies and low interest rates. That serves a form of capitalism which is not the free market. It's not laissez-faire. So in some ways, I think China beats us. So I would say we should do less accusing of China. And if there's something that we're doing wrong, if they're selling something in this country cheaper than we can make it, we need to figure out how to do it, or we let the people decide how they want to spend their money. If they can get stuff cheap and it's good and it's without fraud and force, I think the people should have a right to do that. Buy it cheap and save your money and get into something else. But this whole idea of having tariffs and all—that's just looking for trouble. The trade war that goes on, and I know the other side does a lot of that. But if we can't compete, we need to find out why. In a way, Trump has done a little bit of that by lowering our taxes and lowering the regulations. That did help make us more competitive. But you can't say that we're going to tell China what they have to do. If they're doing something that is, a violation of conventional law and international law in the South China Sea, well, there's a lot of neighbors down there that probably should have more to say about that than I don't quite. I think when we should wake up about what we're going to do with the Chinese Navy if they're in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, but we're in their Gulf of Mexico and think that we should be able to do anything we want and not provoke them. I think our policies too often provoke. And I think that's why our position in the world is being diminished. It's going down. And that's also the reason. It's also the reason that is that our dollar is going to get weaker because we can't maintain this empire. Because we are not productive. Anything that's been looking good even since in the past year, even with coronavirus, even before coronavirus and even before the bubble burst, it was in bad shape. But it's all dependent on debt. If our debt grows rapidly and the artificialness of low interest rates, I mean, this is crazy. Oh, what's the interest rate? Oh, 1%. Oh yeah, but what if you count the inflation that they deny? Oh, it's negative rates. Well, that has nothing to do with good market economics. And that has to do with just rigging the market, and you have winners and losers. Unfortunately, we set ourselves up for an attack by the Marxists, because in the case what we have and most of the West is something that will give a big boost to the big businesses and the banks and the government. And they get the boost. And what happens to the middle class? What's happening? The United States, homelessness, epidemic on the streets, and all the cities going, the chaos in our cities. So the poor are getting poorer. There's more violence. And people, we've actually set ourselves up for the criticism coming from the Marxists. That really bothers me.
There's probably a few things to discuss in there. I guess to begin to unpack that, you kind of rode in on this wave as the forerunner of libertarianism, both in 2008 and 2012 elections. The popularity of that movement seems to have been diminished by Trump's populism, where we talk about tariffs, and also this new generation that's come through Antifa and Black Lives Matter. Can I just get your opinions on sort of what you think has changed in the last 10 years in terms of American society that has created these new political trends?
Well, I'm not pessimistic about the freedom movement and the understanding of Austrian free market economics and sound money. It's quiescent in a way, and the opposition is coming to fruition because it's at its climactic end. Because we've been able to manage this Keynesian position of deficits and printing money, have done it rather well, but we've had to have a tremendous amount of boost and say print money and spend and run up the deficit. But I think what you're seeing on the campuses is not everything that's in the campuses. I happen to talk to a lot of young people who are on the other side of this. And besides, it's not a numbers game, it's quality, people with ideas. And right now, the ideology of the libertarian issues and economics, it's alive and well. And I still am engaged with a lot of them. But the universities, have been disastrous for pushing people into the Congress. I was there more years than I want to count. And I never, there were about five who understood free market economics. They were all Keynesians. They all believed this stuff. But that's a result of, you know, almost 100 years of the junk we get out of our universities. So if you don't deal with that, what I argue is we're not going to be able to take over the universities and teach free markets and sound money. But we have the institutions organized out there where a lot of people are learning about it. You take the Mises Institute, for instance. They have influenced a lot of people, and there's a lot of people. One place where I'm excited about, especially now with the chaos we have here, is the desire to have decent education. And I have a homeschooling group that I've had for several years, but right now the people are begging and pleading for something other than the garbage we're getting out of our government schools. And so I see the positive side on this, and also see that the collapse of what we have is not totally negative. That has to be, that has to be disappeared. But as long as there's trust in our dollars, people will take our dollars, and we'll be a powerhouse, and we'll still have enough collateral and enough money to buy weapons and intimidate people and threaten them with sanctions. And that'll happen. That'll last for a little while longer, but we don't know when the final conclusion will come, when the people just throw in the towel and say, okay, America, we're sick and tired of taking your dollars. That happened in close to the finalizing it back in 1971. The world got sick and tired of Bretton Woods, us printing money like crazy and pretending it was worth $35 an ounce. There's limits to it. Now we're at a different limit. We're at a situation somewhat similar to what happened in 1971 with the collapse of that fictitious system. Well, this was much bigger and much more dangerous because it's a worldwide dependency on a fiat paper money system that is backed only by the United States promising to buy more stuff from them, but not to give them a dollar worth more, but we'll be out there. And also to throw our weight around and promise we'll protect people and put on sanctions on people and financial controls. And then if people need money, we bail them out. We, pass anything out. To maintain the empire is too expensive. And our ability to do that, that'll be one part of the changes that we should look forward to.
Do you see an end game in this? The debt ceiling just continues to rise and rise and rise and rise. I couldn't even count the number. It's into the trillions. But effectively, does this end at any point in time, or how do you deal with this enormous ongoing debt?
Well, it'll be liquidated. To get back to economic growth, we print money. But you can't compare the money we print and the debt is real economic growth. So when you get into this, it's sort of stalemate and the debt has to be liquidated. I like to make the analogy, if we as individuals, kept borrowing money and we wanted to live beyond our means and the banks agreed to give us $100,000 every month and we just blew it. And eventually the bankers say, okay, no more. We're not going to give you any more money. And boom, it crashes. And then after living beyond one's means, when the money is taken away from us, we live beneath our means. Well, that happens in a nation. But how do we do that? Does that mean that all the Ron Paul supporters are going to be in Congress next year? Absolutely not. The stage isn't set for that yet. It has to run its course, because everybody right now seems to think that you have to have more stuff from the government, more debt, and they're just going to fight over who gets it. So they the debt will be liquidated, and you only can liquidate it two different ways. One is, yes, we have more people to Congress. We start voting to cut the budget 10% a year, and finally all the debt gets liquidated. But that is overwhelming. It will never be accepted politically, even though that'll come. you know, the tough way with runaway inflation, the debt will be liquidated. So we will not do it with common sense and backing off and freeing up the economy. We're going to have more of what we've been witnessing here, especially in these last 8 to 10 months, because I think the economic crisis started last fall when the overnight rates soared up to 10%. And people panicked over it, and they had to shift the whole monetary policy where they were trying to wind that down, you know, and shrink the balance sheet. Well, that stopped it. So that ushered in some big corrections, and then we had the coronavirus come along. So the debt will be liquidated. It's being liquidated right now because they don't admit how much inflation there is. So when you get 1% interest on a bond, that's a high price you're paying. The prices are going way up for an investment that is really productive. So the eventually, though, with runaway inflation, all the debt gets wiped off the books, and we won't get that bad, I hope. But you can liquidate debt by devaluing the currency, and they know that, and that's why for how many years now has the United States position, we want to liquidate debt. We want to punish the consumer by making sure our money goes down in value 2% a year. Well, it goes down more than that for a lot of people. And now they're saying, well, you know, it's going to be higher, so we'll have to average it. But what they're doing is stealing from people. They're devaluing the currency, but real debt goes down. Let's say they can do 50%, increase or decrease the value of the currency by 50%. Well, your debt goes down half. So you've liquidated a lot of debt, and you might be able to energize new growth by doing that. But they're not likely to do that. There's going to be a lot of liquidation of debt. I'm sure people in Venezuela don't worry about debt. All they worry about is
surviving.
How many bills can they carry to buy a loaf of bread?
Do you see a date for this ever happening? Because this is the same message that I remember from you going back a number of years. Do you foresee a date when this will come to fruition at all?
Yeah, I see a date, but I don't know where it is. No, the dates are difficult. Austrian economics they're very good in evaluating policies and evaluating trends. So if you create new money, fiat money, tremendously, you will lower the value of the currency. If you keep doing it, then there will be a collapse. It's sort of like, you know, it looked like a few months ago, maybe the stock market was really, really going to crash. But no, you cannot. That involves a lot of subjective things going on. Confidence in our military, confidence in, you know, if next week there's something like an impeachment come along, you know, in the 70s, there was the Nixon problem that came along. Now, if you have political things or some other things and war going on, this will enter into the calculation of the value of the currency. And the answer to the question is, you know, you can't predict the timing. You can predict the trends. And that's what I'm very confident of. The trend will be spending is going to continue, and it's going to be a lot more taxes. They'll tax through the inflation of the currency. And we can predict that will happen. The Congress is not going to stop spending. And the currency is going to go down in value. But your question is, when is the end game? Is it going to be in 3 months, 6 months, or 5 years? And I don't think it's going to be 5 years, but you can't predict the day and time of when that will happen. But it will come, and I'm convinced it's a lot worse than us biting the bullet and just, you know, doing it ourselves and cutting back.
I also just want to ask you about the Democratic nominees as we head into the election. I would assume that you would have known Joe Biden for a number of years and probably still know him. I think a lot of people were a little bit shocked that the Democrats picked the older sort of incumbent person again after the rise of Bernie Sanders, who was sort of an outside dark horse the way that you were years ago. What are your opinions on Biden and in terms of the election itself, his chances of defeating Trump?
Well, it may surprise you. I've never met the man personally. Okay. So I have no personal contact with him. I have an impression from him from probably how you form an impression. But I think that the expression of what's on right now about his mental capacity, I don't know how people put that, because it's astounding. I know politicians patch things together and makes things look worse than others, and that may be the case that they've done some of that. But I think that is a big issue. But his policies have been terrible. Even when people considered him more alert, his policies didn't amount to much. They just bounced around. But that's about pretty characteristic of all the politicians, you know. It's not like, I mean, that's one complaint I have about Tripp. He bounces around. He does something one day. I compliment and say, hey, it's great. You're bringing the troops home from Syria. Next day, somebody else say, oh, no, we better not do that. So that is it. But Biden has done that all the time. I don't think he has foreign beliefs. I think he just, you know, wants to be a politician. That's what most of them want. They want to be there, and they spend the wealth of the country trying to maintain their power and maintain their wealth. So that's where the real tragedy is the motivation of the politicians that go. Rarely do we have run into very many. I could probably name less than a dozen total from the Senate and the House who truly have one goal, and that is to reduce the size and scope of government and to enhance personal liberty and peace on a daily basis. And they don't do anything else other than vote for that direction.
And with that opinion, again, I'm an outsider looking in on the other side of the world. It was very interesting to read and hear about the nomination of Kamala Harris as the VP nomination. Her background is a California prosecutor who seemed to go after people that were apparently innocent, including neglecting DNA testing. And I know this is an area that I've read about you about, you know, freedoms for people as well. Do you know anything about her? Have any opinions about her prior life before getting into politics?
No, not really. I knew about her, you know, her positions on prosecution as a prosecutor, but look how she can do that. And then it turns out that the radical left are satisfied with her. You know, it's just so typical. And it's a sort of the gullibility of the people that is very disheartening. And that's why I think the answers don't come in the political sphere. I don't pay a lot of attention or pretense that all of a sudden it's going to matter. I think, like, this land probably will make a difference. If Trump wins, I think there are some things you could point out that are going to be better. But if you say, what will be different in 10 years from now, I'll say absolutely nothing. Because the Republicans and the Democrats are big government people. And that is what we have to deal with. That's why I'm involved in economic education and homeschooling education. You have to change the minds and views of people. And then the country will change. When the people decide they've had enough. Right now, we're sort of trying to build up the enthusiasm on the Liberty Report that the American people are getting sick and tired of this lockdown. They're starting to speak out, and we've gotten some of the politicians now to back away. The people have to speak out. If people are complaining about the government they have, that means there's still a majority, endorsing it. The ideas are developed by a minority, a smaller minority, and it's education and belief. Eventually, those ideas have to infiltrate and convince, you know, a majority of the people to go along with that, and then that turns into the support for the government. Right now, I would say that we're doing very well in formulating and gathering together a lot of people, you know, that will endorse libertarian ideas. When I went to Congress in the 70s, into Congress, nobody ever heard of libertarianism, and they had come up to me and they said, "Why are you always talking about the Federal Reserve?" You know, but believe me, everybody talks about the Federal Reserve now worldwide because they know how big a deal this is. And if what I suspect is coming, it's going to be a bigger deal because there won't be collusion people who will prop up the dollar. Right now, even the Chinese have to be careful. They threaten at times, "We're going to dump our dollars if you misbehave." But they will not do that because people have, you know, over the years, not wanted to attack the dollar because they're involved in dollars. So the American people and our government has benefited tremendously. But right now, we're not benefiting like that. Our ideas of liberty are diminished compared to other countries. Our financial situation is worse than other countries. Our reaction to the coronavirus has been worse than some other countries that people figured were small little countries, and they've done a much better job in handling this. So, but I still, what I work on is trying to get that 8 or 10% of the population who are influential and will convince young people that there's a different way to go.
Very well.
That's what I think the goal should be.
I've got two more questions for you before we wrap up and finish. One is carrying on with COVID and what you've talked about. I believe that I would know your opinion on the subject matter. When we enter into a pandemic stage where particles in the air and diseases can be transmitted, how does that affect the, I guess, perception of what you're able to do in freedom of movement? What are your opinions on that?
Well, it has a big effect, because most of what you've heard in this whole idea of the pandemic, I call it a hoax. There's a virus and there's an epidemic and a lot of people have got sick, but it's way out of proportion. So the hoax is that the world is turned off, and our statistics that we put out on the Liberty Report every day shows that it came along, it peaked, and the deaths are down, mismanaged it, the data is unreliable, the number of people who died is unreliable. And so that, once again, you need to know the truth about what's going on. But I think in a way you're asking a question, well, what admit there's a problem there. Yeah. Is it the responsibility of the government to control everything by telling people whether they can go to church or not? No, I don't, absolutely do not believe that is the case, because I don't believe it'll do any good, and people can make up their own minds. They should be able to do that, but there is a lot more. It would be challenging to find out how much authority they should have, but our Constitution doesn't give the government and the president any authority to tell people they can't go leave their houses, and they have to stay in their houses. Mm-hmm. And so it's a reflection of the insidious invasion of the people who think that even at the state level they can tell people what to do, and they sort of enjoy the power that they have. That's where the epidemic is. The power mongers have too much control, but the people are waking up and they'll say, enough is enough. Get out of our way. We want to be free people again.
The final question that I have for you today is, as I mentioned, I'm a Canadian who now lives in Australia, and both countries that I live in have some level of nationalized healthcare. And when I read online, one of the biggest debates or problems that people seem to have with the U.S. is the inability to get affordable healthcare, and there's a lot of discussion of nationalizing that. I know that you're not in favor of that, but could you just explain the difficulty and why it's so hard for lower and middle class people to get healthcare that's affordable, that meets their needs without sending them bankrupt?
There's the inflation of the dollar, and it goes in certain areas. It goes to medical care because we pump money into there. So your inflation, it goes to the medical profession. But the people, we don't have anything close to free market medicine. We have corporate medicine, and corporations run it. When I had finished medical school in 1961, we did not have Medicare or Medicaid. I worked in a church hospital for $3 an hour. Nobody got turned away. There was no people in the streets. There was nothing of the chaos that we have here. But then the government came in and said, everything is going to be for free, you know, and all this. But who took over? The corporations took over. The corporation, I just saw, today, one of the drug companies doing a vaccine, you know, for coronavirus, got $1 billion of taxpayers' money to help develop a vaccine, which 20 people are developing, billions and billions of dollars. And it's probably the dumbest thing ever, that all the coronavirus vaccine attempts have always failed. And it's going to be dangerous if they do it. But they got money at the same time. During this period of time of the last several months, this drug company has been increasing their prices to the people. That's corporatism. It has nothing to do with free market. My parents lived at a time where we had free market medicine, and my dad kidded me. when he was doing cleaning up his paperwork, he showed me that when I was born, it cost $35, you know, and, and he had no insurance. He paid all his bills and all this thing. No, corporatism, all that does is feed it to the socialists and to the Marxists and say, see, they can't even get medical care. Well, they can't because we have corporatism. There's a good progressive Democrat will agree with what I'm saying about corporatism, even though they would still follow up on your point. Well, it's bad, so we want the government to do it. How can you expect the government, these individuals, to all of a sudden go to the government and become saints? It doesn't work that way. The market is the answer. Liberty is the answer. With one strict rule, you give up and prohibit any act of aggression. You can't commit fraud, you can't lie, cheat, steal, or kill. And you can have peace and prosperity and good medical care if we follow those rules.
Excellent. Dr. Paul, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers. This episode is brought to you by Romulus IT, offering fast, affordable remote support for common computer problems, including troubleshooting, health checks, virus removal, and software support. Visit RomulusIT.com to get your computer back on track.